This is the Heartland Collegiate Compendium. The legal and regulatory environment of business. Lecture 10, delivered on the 7th of July of 2008. The title of this lecture is Antitrust Law.
Tonight, antitrust law. There will be a PowerPoint in the scrolling marquee on the website by tomorrow evening that will cover the essential elements of antitrust law. Now, there will be two versions. There will be a short version, and then there will be a long version. The short version will get you pretty much everything you would need for a test or a quiz on this kind of material. The longer version gives you more depth of explanations for certain matters. Now, certainly I am not going to go through everything that is in the textbook on this, and there will be, you will notice, you will clearly see where I am not pushing these matters that the book brings up. My interest is more in the pragmatics of you in the business environment, both as a possible victim of antitrust activities and someday maybe as one who could run into certain complaints of your own anti-competitive activities. So again, you will get these, they will be in the scrolling marquee. There will be a short version and then a long version. It's entirely up to you. The short version would get you anything you would need for a quiz or an exam. For some more detailed explanation, you could look at the longer version. Now, not everything in that those versions would be on a test. I go into quite a bit of detail even in the short version. Essentially, it is public policy in this country, in the United States, that the United States government should foster competition in the marketplace. As such, the federal government has over the years enacted various pieces of legislation regulating, controlling, and even outlawing corporate activities that are contrary to this public policy. Now, the reality of the matter historically is that, especially after the Civil War, businesses came together for the specific purpose of controlling markets. What would, by today's standards, be jaw-dropping anti-competitive collusions. And even in that time period, great concern was expressed. In fact, these so-called bosses that essentially ran cities in this country were the subject of cartoons by political cartoonists, condemnation by editorialists, damnation by social commentators and essayists. It was a severely distorted environment, nothing like Adam Smith's concept of free markets. And I am going to spend Wednesday going through Adam Smith's world of what he saw free markets as. And I shall invite you to compare what he said free markets are and how he crafted the argument for capitalism against what we now see and what is now called free markets and capitalism. I think you will find that there is a considerable distinction. And that will be the subject of the lecture on Wednesday. It will be a compact lecture for you to understand what the theory in economics is of free markets versus what you observe the reality to be. By the 1870s, 1880s, our government was the best government money could buy. The consolidation of market power had become so considerable in significant parts of the country, in the urban areas, that essentially our government officials were being elected by bosses. You were not going to be a president of the United States, a senator, a representative, a judge, unless you had the approval of these very wealthy men. Now, how far we are from that in this day and age is the subject of some debate. However, our government in that time was the best government that money could buy, and it was causing monopolies. In that time, the term that was used, and you'll hear me talk about use this term now, the term that was used was trust. A trust was essentially like a holding company, colluding businesses would vest control of their companies up into this trust, into a trust, where they could then allocate market share, fix prices, and proceed to act as a unified monopoly under the disguise of independent corporations. In fact, the trust comprising as its directors the heads of the large colluders was determining everything in the individual companies. And so we hear the term antitrust legislation. You hear terms like trust busters. These trusts became such a significant problem with their monopoly power that by the late 1800s, there was a real social and even to some extent political outcry against them. Monopolies, by the nature of their cost and revenue structures, charge higher prices and provide lower output to the markets than would be the case in perfect competition. And I will get more specific with this concept of competition in Wednesday's lecture. But bear in mind, that there is no question that prices will be higher, output will be lower, and perhaps even quality will suffer greatly in a monopolized market. And that is what we had in the last part of the 19th century. It was a severe problem. But unfortunately, the government was paralyzed to act in the best interests of the nation because that government was a government that was essentially in the pocket of big business, of the trusts. There is no question about it. That is not a theory, that is not a debatable fact, and the right-wingers and the neocons and all of those people now who try to rewrite history cannot change the fact that our country was controlled by money. Well, it always has been, but back then it was a severe problem. It was so severe that in 1890, there was such a political backlash against these trusts that the very first piece of antitrust legislation reflecting a public policy contrary to monopolies came into existence. This was the Sherman Antitrust Act, and it was the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890. This was not just a faint fanfare. I want you to understand, though, this. This was new legislation. This was new territory. And oftentimes, when the government tries to craft new public policy in actionable legislation, it's not particularly a successful venture. You can look back and say, oh, Lord. In fact, if you look at the Sherman Antitrust Act, it was in some ways primitive. If you look at legislation today, or, well, maybe not today, but in the pinnacle of well-written legislation in the decades of the 20th century, you will see that the legislation starts with sections that just define terms, lay out principles, so that courts, so that regulatory agencies, so enforcement can happen. In fact, many pieces of legislation will contain enabling legislation for a regulatory agency to oversee enforcement. The Securities Exchange Act of 1934 put into place a regulatory agency that was charged with overseeing the Securities Act of 1933 and the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 with respect to interpretation, with respect to enforcement. You will see the same thing later with the Federal Trade Commission Act, later than the Sherman Antitrust Act. The Federal Trade Commission Act very specifically created an agency that could oversee the enforcement of it. Hence, when we look at the Sherman Antitrust Act in the context of legislation, it does have a feel of primitiveness to it. There are not those sections defining terms, explaining the point of this, perhaps, explaining the point of this legislation. They're setting into place a regulatory agency and all of that, and charging within the legislation, charging that agency with overseeing enforcement of the act. To that extent, the Sherman Antitrust Act was primitive, and ultimately, lawyers for big business shot it full of holes. They learned from the first, there were some successes. Don't get me wrong. The Sherman Antitrust Act had some successes. Standard Oil, American Tobacco. Standard Oil, American Tobacco. Grr. There were successes, but this was how the big businesses learned. This is how they're going to try to enforce this legislation. This is how we can beat it. We're learning defenses against the prosecutions. Also, the problem was that prosecutors were all over the map. Some prosecutors were very strong, square-jawed. Some were nothing but on the payroll of big business, of the trusts, of the bosses. It was all over the map. Federal enforcement was not all that great at the time anyway. Remember, we were still not that far from the Civil War, where we had established federal supremacy, which was in the Constitution, but Abe Lincoln finally made that point rather clear with that war that wiped out 250,000 citizens. Let me go through. Now, you do not have to write this down. It will be, it's in the book for one thing, and in that PowerPoint. Let me just, hang on here. Let me pull up, and I'm just going to give you an overview. Not the words themselves, but an overview of the two relevant sections of the Sherman Antitrust Act. Section 1 prohibits contracts, combinations, or conspiracies that constitute or create environment for restraint of trade. So if you're going to write this down in notes, write down Section 1 prohibits activities in restraint, pursuant to restraint of trade. Put it down that way. Section 1 prohibits activities pursuant to restraint of trade. Section 2 prohibits monopolies and prohibits monopolization and conspiracies to monopolize. Okay? Now, do you see the kind of the vagueness of the terminology here? Contracts, combinations, conspiracies? Well, what's a conspiracy? Constitute or create an environment for restraint of trade. Well, what's an environment for restraint of trade? They were handing an awful lot to the courts. The legislature was handing a lot to the courts to interpret. Now, Section 2, again, this prohibits monopolization and conspiracies to monopolize. Well, what exactly is a conspiracy to monopolize? If two competitors walk up to each other and talk about how's business, is that a conspiracy? If one competitor says to the other, well, I'm going to set my prices next week at such and such, and then walks away, is that a conspiracy? The courts had to craft violations from this fuzziness. Interestingly, the economics textbook that is used here says that the Sherman Antitrust Act had no per se violations in it. That's false. That is just on its face false, because essentially the courts determined that there are per se violations. In other words, the plaintiff must show that the action occurred. But generally, which would otherwise be the case with the Sherman Act, or in any act, Anti-Monopolization Act, it would also have to be shown that this harmed competition. So the two standards generally would be, first, that something was done in restraint of trade, and second, that it harmed competition. However, the courts very quickly, well, not very quickly, but the courts came to interpret the Sherman as having per se violations, where all that was necessary was to show that the restraint of trade activity did happen. You didn't have to go to the second round and show that it harmed competition. All you had to do was show that it happened. Price fixing was one of those. In price fixing, all the plaintiff had to do was show that the price fixing was carried out. There was a conspiracy to restrain trade through price fixing. The next rung to show that it actually harmed trade, harmed competition, didn't have to be shown. So, yes, Sherman does have per se violations. They are not common within Sherman, and it was the courts that had to craft the relevant per se violations. But there are per se violations. But again, in general, unless it's a per se violation, a plaintiff would have to first show that the monopolizing activity occurred, and then show that it harmed competition. And that would be generally the case, unless it is a per se violation, in which case only the action, the anti-competitive action itself, was carried out. I'm trying to think, there are actually, I could give you several. The one that's the most normal is price fixing agreements. But there's another one, and it's just slipping my mind right now. It just irritates me to no end. I cannot remember what it was, and I would know, there's no way I would find it. But, Anyway, let me move on. The Sherman Antitrust Act was indeed an effort, and a good effort. It was a demonstration that there are times in American history when legislatures can act against their own self-interest in terms of money in their pockets. It happens, but it's not common. Sherman was one of those. Now, generally speaking, though, however, understand that this was an era of big business. There were some ugly instabilities occurring in the American economy in this time. There were runs on banks. There were other problems. And there was a sense, there really was a sense that things were going wrong. Perhaps the same sense that's happening now. People will sit back and let governments do absolute terrible things to the world, to certain ethnic minorities. But there seems to be in American history these breaking points where enough is enough. And it's almost like the society surges back, almost like pent-up moral decency suddenly explodes. We've seen this happen several times in American history on different fronts. Perhaps a great example, there are several wonderful examples, and I wanted to go through those in this place right here. I usually do. One example in high school or in any other course, did you ever learn about the massacre at Wounded Knee? Someone said yes? Okay, let me give you... When I was up in the Dakotas, one of my favorite places to be, I go up there is whenever I can. There's a chapel on a hill out in the middle of nowhere. This is where Wounded Knee is. You get up there in the summertime, it's up a long driveway. Down at the bottom, there are these little Native American kids trying to sell trinkets. Hardly anyone ever goes to the knee anymore. You get up on that hill in the summer and it's 125 degrees, 40 mile an hour wind, no humidity. It is like quite spiritual if you're into that kind of thing. The knee was where a massacre occurred. Federal troops were watching, keeping an eye on these Native Americans back in the 1800s, very concerned that the Native Americans were getting ready for some kind of a rebellion. And unfortunately, there was a small group of these Native Americans who began an ancient dance, a ghost dance, calling upon the ancestors to come down and give them strength, which was interpreted as strength for battle. And seemingly, like in a lightning shot, the Federals just started shooting. Just shot and shot and shot. Men, women, children. The people were running for their lives, trying to run up this hill. Just slaughtered them in their tracks. Well, the newspapers around the country reported this very quickly. And it was almost like this national outrage exploded. We treated the American Indians like shit. We had always treated them like shit. We'd violated treaty after treaty, but for some reason, this was just like a snap. God, what did we do? Well, that wasn't the first massacre. We'd done horrible massacres, much worse than Wounded Knee. But somehow the knee just suddenly pulled everyone up by the roots and said, look what you do! God's sakes, get off it! And this isn't the only time this has happened in history. The Sherman Antitrust Act was sort of the same kind of... The country is being run by these bosses. We write cartoons about these huge, fat pigs who sit around manipulating the politics of the nation. Finally, there was like a snapping point. And there were actually a couple of pieces of this snapping point. The Sherman Antitrust Act was almost like a pre-warning of what was going to come in the second decade of the 20th century. Now let me point out again, these things happen from time to time in American history. The great stock market crash of 1929 was not all there was to the big changeover that happened with the election of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. There were other parts to it too. There was an incident after World War I veterans got their benefits cut. They were just not being given any money. And a great number of them descended on Washington, and back at that time, you could do it. They just camped out on the White House grounds, just parked themselves there. Injured, disabled veterans, miserable people. Some of them, no limbs. War is horrible, and it certainly was then. Many of them with terrible lung diseases from breathing the gases that the Huns were pouring at us in the trenches from World War I. And social commentator Will Rogers said, this was the most well-behaved group of starving men I had ever seen in my life. Just pitched their tents, just so they could have the president have a look. You know, we want to talk to the president. Just tell him, here's the problem we have. Well, instead, the federal troops charged the people in the camp on horseback. A full cavalry charge, swords drawn. Hacking, chopping. Those were the kinds of events that just finally said to the nation, this is not the way we are supposed to be. One more in the same, and I'm trying to emphasize, show you something about law and society. In 1960, Jack Kennedy, a very new kind of president, was elected. Glamorous. Handsome man, beautiful, elegant wife. I mean, these were the people of the new age of America. Gorgeous, good looking, with it, hip. They could do, I mean, Sinatra was there, you know, Marilyn Monroe. It was almost like Hollywood in the White House. And Jack Kennedy set forth a new way that he wanted us to proceed through the rest of the 20th century. He even went so far as to challenge the American people that we were going to put a man on the moon by the end of the decade. And of course, the engineers and scientists all said, "What? Are you nuts?" Well, we did. And he did a lot of other things, or at least he wanted to. And then in Dallas, one headshot, perfect headshot, ended that. And his vice president, not a man from the East like Jack Kennedy, not a man of blue blood like Jack Kennedy. His vice president was Lyndon Baines Johnson, old blue dog Democrat, politics of the South, racist, mean Texas politics. Lyndon Johnson took over as president, sworn in. Jack was still on the table with his head half off when Lyndon Johnson was sworn in. And one of the things that Jack Kennedy had wanted to do was to have civil rights legislation. And we're going to get to that next week. Civil rights legislation that was going to finally say once and for all, you may not discriminate in this country on the basis of race, sex, creed, or national origin. For finally, this dream of the American Constitution of a republic for the people, by the people, and of the people was going to be realized in its fullness by a Civil Rights Act. This was Jack Kennedy's desire. Well, you can imagine how that went over with an old blue dog Democrat like Lyndon Johnson and his good old boys. Can you imagine those boys in the South, those Democrats in the South? Oh, thank God. God, that prissy Eastern boy is dead. And finally, we got one of our kind in the White House. No more of this talk about letting Negroes sit at the same table with us. And God knows if you let them do that, then they might be starting to date our white women and all that kind of stuff. And then we'd have to sit with them at the workplace. Thank God, Johnson. Well, you know something strange happened? Lyndon Johnson saw it as his duty to fulfill Jack Kennedy's dream. And he started bringing those blue dog Democrats into the White House. There are some famous photographs. Johnson leaning over a chair of a fellow blue dog Democrat and just screaming at him, spit flying. You are going to vote for this Civil Rights Act. This is what Jack wanted. It's time. I know. I don't like it any more than you do. Letting colored people be with us and all that. But this, it's time we do it. It's just time. And besides, this was what Jack wanted, and he kind of sacrificed something pretty big for this, you know, his life. So we're going to do this. And by God, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was born. Not with Jack Kennedy, an enlightened Eastern liberal from a blue blood family that never actually had to sit with black people, but from a blue dog Southern Democrat, racist to the bottom of his soul. Sometimes history works funny that way. It's not always the enlightened. The Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890 was not passed by liberals, was not pushed by liberals. Matter of fact, the president, I would doubt if anyone would accuse the president in 1890 of being some kind of consumer advocate. He was in the pocket of big business just like anyone else was, but somehow, sometimes, it's that insider that's the one who has to do the right thing, and probably that's the one who is able to do it. There's a big difference between having an Eastern liberal effect with an Eastern liberal accent tell you to do something and having some old boy from the South tell you to do it. Times began to change. There was a window. You saw these spurts of progressiveness starting in the 1800s. Certainly in the earlier part of the 1800s, there were spurts too. There was wonderful poetess who was an activist against child labor long before people were enlightened to the horrors of child labor.
And I would encourage you to see if you can find this poetess or one of her famous poems was I Do Not Love Thee. And that's all I'll tell you about her. After the Civil War, certainly the Knights of Labor came about, and if you take an economics course from me, I'll teach you about labor, the history of the labor movement. Socialist to the bottom of its soul. It didn't last long, but that was really a big shot. A labor movement, when labor movements were, you were going to get your head busted in by the cops, by the private security thugs, and by about everyone else for trying to run a labor movement. Here were the Knights of Labor, not only trying to organize, but calling for things like, oh, shockers, like work weeks that were not 60 hours long. Real shocker, Knights of Labor were calling for equal pay for equal work. Can you believe that? Knights of Labor, back in the 1800s. Oh, what a far-fetched idea. Pay women the same as men? How strange can you get? And then this Sherman Antitrust Act, another punk, these little slices of the 20th century showing up in the 19th century. Now, actually, I wrote an article about this, and I'm thinking about maybe putting this up. You might want to read it. It's called The 21st Century Epilogue, talking about how you can see slices of the next century in a previous century. And certainly, the outrage of the massacre at Wounded Knee, the Knights of Labor, and the Sherman Antitrust Act were slices of the 20th century popping up in the 19th century. It even got more severe. These little rumbles were getting louder. Very brief time in the second decade of the 20th century, we had a liberal, but I don't know if you'd call him a liberal by modern standards, but a liberal president. I mean, that was pretty shocking. Woodrow Wilson. Unfortunately, Wilson was also very much a naive man. But there was certainly a desire of the people, at least briefly, to toy with a liberalism, with a view of government that was more expansive, that we could have public policy, and not just have public policy, but have laws that enforce these public policies, and that what is good for business is not always good for America. So we had Woodrow Wilson, sort of a liberal president, also a naive man. He was suckered into things, unfortunately. By some accounts, he was suckered into our involvement in World War I, the Great War. And they didn't call it World War I back then. Obviously, they weren't preparing to start counting world wars. But nevertheless, he and Congress had become more sensitive to the distinction between business interests and the nation's interest. And so, this Sherman Antitrust Act, which had successfully prosecuted several companies, several trusts, but which had eventually come apart under an onslaught of powerful lawyers representing powerful business interests. The Sherman Act had to be amended. And the amendment to the Sherman Act is called the Clayton Act of 1914. And again, the Clayton Act is an amendment to the Sherman Antitrust Act. You gotta understand that what was happening this time, there were real turbulent forces that essentially crashing into each other. An ancient concept of hierarchical authoritarian power slamming headlong into this emerging people's power. The power of the private versus the power of the public. In the same era, something that was definitively contrary, at least ultimately, to the interests of the people was coming about in the Federal Reserve Act. But at the same time, you saw this I don't want to say pro-consumer, it was pro-public policy for the people kind of legislation. Now, The Clayton Act of 1914 really tied down and put points of reference into antitrust law. Section 2 outlawed price discrimination where there is no actual cost difference. Section 2 again outlaws price discrimination where there is no actual cost difference. In other words, you can't charge different prices to different buyers unless you really do have cost difference. Section 3 prohibits exclusivity clauses in vendor agreements. Again, Section 3 prohibits exclusivity clauses in vendor agreements. It prohibits, in this regard, exclusivity agreements. Let me be specific. Tie-in sales and bundling are outlawed. Tie-in sales and bundling. Now, let me point this up to you. This is not ancient, useless legislation. Microsoft finally got its ass nailed to the ground, unfortunately, long after it had already done all of its damage to the software world. But Microsoft finally got its ass nailed to the wall exactly because of its violations of exclusivity clauses. Let me give you an example of what Microsoft did. When the Windows, first Windows, are any of you old enough to remember the original Windows 95? I mean, these stupid little icons, it was just, all it was DOS with a graphical user interface, so you didn't have to type DOS commands. You could click on a mouse, which is basically what it is to this day. I mean, people are too lazy to type at a DOS prompt, so they have to clicky an icon. But, here's how it worked. Now, Windows 95 was actually fairly popular, and a number of computer manufacturers were starting to put Windows 95 and Windows operating system on their computers. Now, people knew that Microsoft, well, certainly the computer world, the computer savvy people, knew Microsoft was not particularly a wonderful company. It essentially had stolen the concept of a graphical user interface from the Macintosh people. As a matter of fact, it wasn't essentially it stole it. It did. Bill Gates consciously kept harping on his software engineers. I want it to look like a Mac. I want it to look like a Mac. Essentially, he stole the concept. He also pulled off the same kind of thing when he put out his MS-DOS, which was essentially just a ripoff of DOS before it. But he was feeling very powerful by the time we got into the early to mid-1990s, and he essentially made a calculated risk. By the way, this is all established in the Microsoft v. United States. He wanted to get into the internet. He saw that this was where the future was going to be. Now, that doesn't require visionary. That wasn't a visionary thing. Most of us back then knew the internet was going to explode because several years in the early 1990s, very early 1990s, a small group of senators had pushed through a very expensive upgrade to our telecommunications system, federally paid for, that paved the way for the internet as we know it. Now, interestingly enough, the fellow who spearheaded this effort in the Senate was none other than the man at the time, Senator Al Gore. He made the mistake in the 2000 race of saying, "I invented the internet." And of course, he was made fun of greatly by even people who supported him some. But in fact, in a way, he and his group did by getting the government to put billions of dollars into the telecommunications system to make it strong enough to handle the internet and turn the telecommunications system towards that kind of digital age. Yeah, there's a lot of argument that that was sort of the invention of the internet as you guys know it. Now, there was an internet before you were around. We called it ARPANET, and we were on that back in the 70s and 80s, us geeks were. But Bill Gates saw this internet. All this federal money had been put into it, and it was going to explode. Well, the browser that was a browser, something that could actually read a code page, a page of code, and turn it into a visual experience. That's what a browser does. The browser that was on the market dominant was Netscape's Navigator. And I don't know if any of you ever remember it. Had a wheel of a ship on a blue horizon. I love Netscape Navigator. Oh, Bill Gates saw, here's something I can rip off again. I'm a ripoff artist. That's what Bill Gates was. That's how he built Microsoft, ripping off ideas and then marketing them. So he had something, a browser, which really sucked, not nearly as good as Netscape Navigator at the time. His was called Internet Explorer. But he had a wedge with all of these computer manufacturers. You see, the computer manufacturers were putting Windows 95 on because it was a great thing. But they were also, of course, he was putting Netscape Navigator on their computers. So what did Bill Gates do? His people started calling Compaq, these companies. You know, we're giving you a site license to put our Windows, our very popular Windows on your computer. If you don't start putting Internet Explorer on and get rid of this Netscape Navigator, we're going to pull your license to put Windows 95 on your computers that you're selling. Of course, everyone, oh my God, no, no, no. So Netscape Navigator was kicked off these manufacturers, OEM software. Internet Explorer was put on. You see what bundling is? You see bundling? Good. Now, let me give you another example. One of the things that Microsoft had been doing for a while was when you got, this might be closer to your time. For some time, when you got Windows, you got a computer that had Windows on it, you also got Word. But what that did was that destroyed WordPerfect. Why would you go and buy WordPerfect, which was the premier dominant word processing software? I used WordPerfect for years. I still have WordPerfect, for God's sake. But why would you use WordPerfect? Why would you go out and buy WordPerfect if Word comes on your system? Okay? Do you see how that would constitute a defeat of competition? You see that second part of the test? You're not only doing something anti-competitive, but it's actually it's causing harm to competition. Okay, that was Section 3. Section 7 prohibits mergers, acquisitions, and other ownership arrangements that create market concentration. Again, Section 7 prohibits mergers, acquisitions, and other ownership arrangements that create market concentration. You notice how the Clayton Act is getting much more specific. It's getting down to business. Now, in the same year, this one, which was a separate piece of legislation, Clayton was an amendment to Sherman, essentially to beef it up. But this other one was the Federal Trade Commission Act. Now, the most important thing about the Federal Trade Commission Act was that it created the Federal Trade Commission, an actual agency charged with overseeing the laws addressing the competitive landscape in the United States. The Federal Trade Commission exists to this day. And although its record has been somewhat checkered, especially of recently, by simply letting these companies merge willy-nilly, it seems like. But in general, over the history of the FTC, especially after World War II, it did take its mission quite seriously. And as all regulatory agencies, it has the power to interpret the act under which it was formed and all relevant legislation with which it is charged. It also has the ability to create regulatory law. It can create regulatory law. So in this regard, just like all agencies, it can interpret. This is called regulatory interpretation. It can look at the laws that it is charged with enforcing and create interpretations of those laws. But it can also create regulatory law pursuant to its mission. So these two are there, and with the FTC, just like with other regulatory agencies, you see this power. Finally, the agency itself can prosecute, can sue civilly on behalf of the people of the United States. It can also refer to federal prosecutors for criminal prosecution violations that rise to the level of crimes. So, just like most regulatory agencies, it can itself have standing to sue on the basis of its enabling legislation. It has standing to sue on behalf of the United States government, essentially on behalf of the American people. It also has the ability to refer for criminal prosecution to the Justice Department. Usually it refers to the prosecutors in the Justice Department for if it's a criminal violation. And the Supreme Court has determined that a company can be sued and can be prosecuted for what essentially is the same act. Now, that sounds like double jeopardy, doesn't it? But that's not how the Supreme Court has seen it, sees it. That's great, but it's also real bad. And in the hands of bad prosecutors, of bad regulators, it can be used in very bad ways. As was the case when Karl Rove orchestrated both civil and criminal prosecution of a Democratic governor as part of an overall plan or scheme to create a permanent Republican majority. There is no question that this is what happened. And in fact, it got the egregiousness of his orchestration of the prosecution of Governor Siegelman was so obvious that a very conservative federal court of appeals has now ordered not just a retrial of Siegelman, but also ordered him to be released from prison while he is getting his second time in court. But the original prosecution of Siegelman was both criminal and civil. They beat the living shit out of him. They destroyed him financially. They had him fighting prosecutions on multiple levels. And that's what is bad about this ability that the Supreme Court has given the government to do both civil and criminal prosecutions at the same time. Done properly and done for public policy, good public policy, they are a way to seek redress both against for wrongs against the society and against its people. But done for the wrong reasons, they can create a nightmare of authoritarianism that can lead to what we've had in the guise of party politics, which rose to the level of what are probably in the next years to come going to be considered to be absolutely shameful acts. Now let me move on here. The Federal Trade Commission, and you'll hear me refer to it as the FTC. The FTC is a B2B. It's business to business. You as a consumer don't have any business trotting up to the FTC. But if you are a business, you can seek redress through the FTC for what you see as anti-competitive practices that are in violation of law. Now, let me point out, the FTC didn't just create the Federal Trade Commission. It tightened up, it put some more meat into antitrust law. One of the things that it did was it actually defined and made illegal predatory pricing. Predatory pricing, if you take an economics course, you will hear predatory pricing described as charging a price that is below the marginal cost of production for the purpose of harming your competition. Charging a price below your marginal cost of production for the purpose of harming your competition. Now, the most famous example of this, and I actually wrote an article about this, it was a sore spot for decades, and I, probably not your time you've ever heard of it, but in my time it was real. The Standard Oil Trust, John D. Rockefeller, one of his nastiest habits, he'd go into a town with his gas stations. This was back when cars were getting popular. And what he would do is he'd just put up his gas station and charge a price that was ridiculously lower than any other gas station in town. And he'd just keep it there. Well, eventually, all the other gas stations would go out of business because no one would get gas at them. And then, of course, John D. would buy up these gas stations. And then he would have a spatial monopoly, geographic control of a market. And then, of course, he could charge whatever he wanted for gasoline. And in my time, I come from an old family. I shall stipulate that I come from an old family. But when I lived in my growing up years, you'd go down a hill, and we didn't have automatic transmissions. You were at the top of the hill, my father would just throw the car out of gear, put it in neutral, and just start going down the hill. And, you know, in Kentucky, you could go down some pretty steep hills. And he'd always say, well, we're going to cheat John D. for a while here. I mean, the hatred of that man was that deep that even, you know, years after the man had died, you still went down the hill with your car out of gear to save some gas because that was cheating old John D. And that was the depth of with which the disdain was for him. And to this day, his descendants are still powerful people in this country controlling things far more than they should, considering old John D. did everything he did to cheat the nation. And sometimes to this day, I'll actually put my car, my automatic transmission, out of gear and coast just to cheat old John D., or at least to cheat his descendants. Now, let me explain, though. Predatory pricing is not always there, even if you might think it's there. Have you ever seen the grocery store ads, eggs, 25 cents a dozen, bread, 35 cents a loaf, something that is just a ridiculously low price for one good? Those are called loss leaders. Now, even though there is no question that a loss leader is priced below the cost of production, the cost of purchase, it is not illegal to have a loss leader or two, because the purpose is not to harm your competition. The purpose of having hamburger 99 cents a pound this week only is to get people to come into your store so they'll buy the hamburger, and before they'll leave, they'll buy a bunch of other stuff. You're not trying to break the back of your competitors, the other grocery stores. You're just trying to get people in your store. Have you ever seen loss leaders? I mean, unfortunately, some people, my dear mother, she would spend more money on gas going from store to store for its loss leaders. She would look straight down the aisle. Where is that cheap stuff? And then she'd leave. So that's not normal, though. Most people, you go into a store to buy one cheap thing. By the time you're out of there, your wallet is smoking. Have you ever gone into a store and you plan to buy one thing and there's, anyway, a small personal issue. Anyway. Loss leaders are not predatory pricing. They're not. But I want you to remember, I oftentimes will ask that question on a quiz or an exam, loss leaders. And I do want you to know what they are, because certainly in business, they're brought up from time to time in marketing classes. But I also want you to know that this is a great example of where there might appear to be a technical violation of the law, but it's not a violation of the law because the purpose in this is not to hurt your competition. The purpose is just to get some customers in the door to buy your more expensive marked up stuff. And that's often true. You'll see that with a lot of stores. They'll have a sale on one thing, but everything else is jacked up in price. And then you'll also have the stores, they'll jack everything up in price and then put everything on sale, which really irritates me. I want you to take a break for a few minutes, and then we'll come back to this. Okay, we are back now. One last point that I want to make about the Federal Trade Commission Act of 1914. It was expanded in several directions by amendment. In 1938, the Federal Trade Commission Act was amended to give the FTC the broad scope in mission to prohibit, quote, unfair or deceptive practices in commerce. The act was amended in 1938 to broaden its scope to include, quote, unfair or deceptive practices in commerce. Now, in 1936, the Clayton Act was amended by what was called the Robinson-Patman Act. This act is sometimes known as the Chain Store Act. And again, the Robinson-Patman Act of 1936 is actually an amendment to Section 2 of the Clayton Act. And it is called the Chain Store Act because it was enacted to protect independent retailers from being driven out of business by the big chains of stores that were beginning to show up actually in the 1920s. Among its provisions, this is the Robinson-Patman Act. Discounts, free advertising, or promotional concessions cannot be offered to some but not others. Again, discounts, free advertising, or promotional concessions cannot be offered to some, but not others. Quantity or volume discounts cannot be offered if they, quote-unquote, substantially lessen competition. Again, quantity or volume discounts cannot be offered if they substantially lessen competition. Locational price variations, as well as predatory pricing, are prohibited. Now, predatory pricing was already prohibited by the Federal Trade Commission Act. However, this expands that the idea of pricing as an anti-competitive mechanism to include locational pricing variations that aren't based upon true business interests. Now, let me very briefly explain to you. In the 20s, there was a, it was before that, really. The 20th century heralded changes that people, at least some people, saw. Industrialization was on the march. And already there was a growing sense of this industrialization eating away something that was essentially American that had been before that. As I had told you before, Thomas Jefferson lived long enough to see his dream of a huge agrarian nation giving way to smokestacks and miserable, grimy cities. Certainly, by the late 1800s, factories, degrading, miserable work environments were everywhere. And the intellectual Karl Marx had already begun and completed great writings explaining the continuity of history in terms of these kinds of acquisitions of power and wealth by controllers of capital, and that there would be cycles in history. As his teacher, Georg Hegel, had said, history has an inevitability to it. Certain events lead to certain other events. And in economic terms, these periods of capital controllers gathering wealth and creating alienation would lead to rebellion. Art is one of the wonderful ways to express fear, concern, pain, frustration. And one of my favorite early 20th century painters is a man named Hopper. Now, you've probably seen one of his paintings, or at least some obscenely distorted version of it. He did a painting called Nighthawks, which was wonderful, and I'll show you that one first. Nighthawks describes modernity in unflattering terms. These were the restaurants that were becoming typical in the landscape post-World War II. Now, the next one I'll show you was pre-World War II. But notice what's happening in Nighthawks. This is a clean, sterile environment. Pre-made store. A pre-made restaurant. This pool of bright light in a bleak landscape of human experience in the 20th century. The tables are glossy, shiny, clean stainless steel pots for coffee. And look at these people here. The shadowy figure just by himself, alone. There's nothing for him to look at. Half not even there, half enshrouded in shadow. The young man talking. No one listens. And then we have this couple. They don't look at each other. She's worried about her nails. He's just staring off wherever. They all look nice. They all look well-dressed. They're all sitting in the pool of light, each one of them alone in the 20th century. This is the alienation in the sterile, clean, bright pool of light in the infinite void. This is the kind of restaurant that is for the 20th century. Now, this painting. These started coming up in the 1920s. These little tiny coffee stand restaurants where you essentially got your own stuff. You got your coffee. There might be other snacks in there too. Now, when I was a kid along the interstates, you could pull into these kinds of restaurants where there was no attendant. You could just put money into a machine and these turnstiles would rotate and you could get a sandwich, juice, milk. You even had microwaves, yes, before microwaves were known in households. But in this painting, this is called The Automat, another Hopper painting. Dapper, dapper, pretty girl. All fashionable, 1920s, just perfect, and perfectly alone. These chain stores, dominating landscape, no labor required, cheap as hell to run them. Volume, the more of them you make, the more money you make. One store makes a net profit of $20 a day. You put up 1,000 of these, your chain is making $20,000 a day, hardly any labor. No regular mom-and-pop restaurant could possibly compete. Not even a mom-and-pop coffee shop could possibly compete. And this was the perfect place for the 20th century, for the pretty girl sitting with her back to the eternity of alienation and aloneness behind her, just all dressed up and no place to go, but back into that black void where even the lights of the restaurant itself can't reach very far. The Chain Store Act, the Robinson-Patman Act, was an effort to try to stop this sweeping tide of consumer industrialization, of mechanization, routinization, essentially, at the end of the day, of a degradation of the human experience from a community where people may maybe go to a restaurant and sit around and talk to each other. We went to a society where we can all go to a cheap place where we can be alone in a crowd. Besides, why else would you want to dress up to go out and have a cup of coffee if not to be alone and turn your back to the void of your alienation? That's the context of the Robinson-Patman Act. Now, you might want to make the observation, well, wait a minute. This is still going on. Walmart is destroying mom-and-pop businesses all across the country. Meijer is doing that. These automated gas stations. Who goes to a real service station where a real guy comes out and he might be able to check your oil? Where could you even find something like that anymore? Hell, you ask your kids, would you rather go to a family mom and pop restaurant or you want to go to McDonald's? McDonald's! Well, of course they do. Who needs a family restaurant when you can go to McDonald's, where everything is made of plastic, everything is clean, and you get your food in a styrofoam box. So when you think about it, this legislation that was in, like, the Robinson-Patman Act, you think about the Clayton Act, and then you say, now, wait a minute, the telecoms, the Bell Trust was busted, but now we've got just a couple of telecoms, and seems like every couple of months you read about mergers of giants to become even larger giants, and now the telecoms are such giants that they are seriously on the verge of being given the immunity that only nations get, the immunity from prosecution for spying on their own citizens. You might notice that these great efforts that came in the early part of the 20th century are now under great assault. And you want to keep that in mind whenever you are trying to craft an idea of what constitutes the public policy and what we are doing to pursue that public policy in this country. Now, let me finish this up. As far as antitrust exemptions go, there are a number of organizations that are exempt from antitrust legislation. For example, labor unions have their own laws that exempt them. So they're exempt from the antitrust legislation that I've laid out for you tonight. Okay. Public utilities. There are state and federal statutes particular to them, regulatory bodies that oversee those monopolies. Professional sports franchises like baseball, they are essentially allowed to police themselves and otherwise to operate like baseball operates as just a pure trust. It's a trust. Well, I shouldn't say a trust. It is a cartel. And if it were subject to antitrust law, it would be in violation clearly of antitrust law. Collusion, open collusion, everything you could imagine. The sports franchise owners collude, but they're exempt. And of course, that makes you wonder what the federal government was doing, making those senators and representatives making political points for themselves with that steroid scandal last year, hauling in athletes and having a commission, a blue ribbon commission. Why the hell are you doing this? You have exempted this entire industry, but suddenly, instead of coming down on the owners for running a cartel, you're coming down on the baseball players because somehow they've offended the sensibilities of the American people by pumping steroids. There are cooperatives of U.S. exporters that really are collusions, but they are exempt. Let me give you an example. Suppose you wanted to ship some stuff you've made overseas to sell. Now, what you can do is enter into an agreement with even your competitors so that you can get a decent rate for all of your stuff to get on a cargo ship, get space on a cargo ship to take it across the ocean. There's nothing wrong with that. Those are exempt from antitrust legislation. Okay? Now also, HMOs and hospitals are exempt. Even though hospitals are clearly spatial monopolies in many areas, the theory there was with hospitals that frequently, at least in the old days, a rather significant geographical area might have only one hospital serving it. And so you certainly didn't want to say that's a monopoly and we're prosecuting it because that was the only hospital that would service a very large population because of the costs involved. Now, HMOs are exempt, but they are undergoing scrutiny. It's often on. HMOs are very powerful politically with campaign contributions and quote-unquote grassroots organizations that are really nothing but corporate-funded organizations that buy politicians off and all that. Amtrak is exempt. Now, military equipment suppliers are exempt from antitrust legislation because of national security concerns. And also, intra-city newspaper agreements like shared printing facilities are exempt. Now, this has been abused in recent years by large newspapers in a metropolitan area, essentially having had agreements for shared printing with smaller newspapers, more or less deciding that they are going to just simply destroy those smaller newspapers by saying, we're no longer going to share our printing facilities, therefore you are out of business, now we get your market. Great examples of that have happened all over the country where one newspaper has just essentially monopolized the market and they are protected in this way. Now also, there is controversial legislation that keeps trying to find its way through the FTC to allow for multimedia ownership, for newspapers to also own and control large numbers of radio stations. Right now, there is a dominant radio station in the United corporation called Clear Channel, very conservative, probably qualifying, well, I don't say probably, let me not pull my punches. It is extremist right wing. It controls a huge number of radio stations in the United States, and it's gobbling up more every day or every week. And Clear Channel is working very hard to get antitrust, to get more latitude to go into other markets, not just to consolidate control of all the radio stations in single markets, but also to get into other kinds of media. The same is true of Rupert Murdoch, who is behind Fox Network and the right-wing Fox News. He has successfully managed to get the United States to look the other way as he has gobbled up control of more and more media outlets, not just broadcast, but now something like the Wall Street Journal is under his control. And there's extreme concern that the idea of an independent, widely opinionated right-wing, left-wing, liberal, conservative media in the United States has essentially vanished and is vanishing and has vanished into a corporate control by one political philosophy. And we are seeing that all the time these days, and it's gotten more severe. There are notable exceptions. However, when you think of the dominance of Rupert Murdoch in the United States, this is trust, or, well, not trust, well, yeah, it is trust. This is monopoly, monopolization, Clear Channel. Clearly, this is contrary to the public policy that was so stated in 1890. But here we are in the 21st century where money talks, and again, money is talking to the reins of power, and the reins are pulling us into not just the spiral of monopolies again, but also into the spiral of right-wing monopolies. Corporatist monopolies. By definition, when the government and corporations come together, the term for that politically is fascism. That's what fascism is. A unification of corporate and government interests into a single governing entity. We saw it in Nazi Germany, and I would caution us that we are seeing it again in 21st century America. The last time it happened, it was terrible, and this time I should expect nothing better. On Tuesday, I'm sorry, yeah, it should be up actually tonight, if I can get around to it, but it'll probably be tomorrow. In the Scrolling Marquee, there will be two PowerPoints. One will just be the extended version of the other. It will be on monopolies. It will be what I will hold you responsible for. Okay? That's all I have for you tonight. I thank you.